One of the problems of talking then about art is that I'm already out of my media. I would much rather be up in my chalet painting, which is my business. But in order to try and share some of the excitement of the field that I'm in, it behooves me from time to time to stand up and to say a few words about it. You're going to get this morning a concise, in fact, I think probably about 45 minutes, a history of the relationship of art and the church. And that goes from the time of Christ up into our own present time. That's a lot of time to cover in 45 minutes. The best way of doing that is to, first of all, it's to begin. But after that, it's to sort of get diarrhea of the mouth, you know, just sort of open it up and let everything just flood out. In the process of doing that, there may be some things which have been lost in translation or come out rather abstractly. It's not a good idea to generalize. You can generalize something to death. But I would like for you to sort of get a hold of the excitement of this, and so I'm going to deal with big, happy ideas and some pretty spectacular images. And so I would hope if there are questions, there probably won't be time to do it right now, but if you want to come up to Chalet 4 and watch me paint, I'll be happy to talk to your questions while I'm doing my own thing. Okay, Matthew? The early church did not decide at the time that it wanted to make its art that since they were all early Christians, they would develop a style of art and they would call it early Christian. We have a whole bunch of textbooks that label this particular style early Christian, and that's kind of silly. There is no such style. Early Christians were actually late Romans, or they were late North Africans, or wherever the early Christians happened to be. And so you wind up with a bunch of styles and conflicts of styles which were really kind of perplexing. Like, for example, the picture on the right, which is from a tomb, a sarcophagus, shows Christ on the throne of judgment, and the throne of judgment is held up by Zeus, the god of the sky. That's absolutely the only way those people could comprehend Christ sitting on the throne of judgment, and I think it's kind of beautiful. I think it's beautiful because it sure eliminates any possibility of there being a discussion of the difference between sacred and secular. I just love to throw this slide on. Was the fellow who created this thing Christian or not? If he was Christian, what did he do with Zeus in there? If he was secular, what did he do with Christ in there, and where do those two things meet? Well, they met in the faith of the fellow who could only interpret what he knew to be true in the idioms with which he was familiar. The picture on your right, up here, right above me, I just show you to prove that just simply because you're a Christian doesn't mean you're an artist. That has got to be one of the dumbest. You can find art like that in most every latrine in the country. And just because they were found in the catacombs doesn't mean that we have to write a long tome about the plastic inconsistencies of early Christian milieu, that sort of silly nonsense. These people were scratching. They were full of hope. There was nothing in the caves, in those catacombs, that showed any signs of despair. And I think it's kind of particularly kind of amazing that the hope sign was there, even though the next morning they would be fed to the lions. What early Christians had was an iconography of place.
place was extremely important to them, so that when they built their little churches, the place where they built them was as important as the style in which they built them. So along the Sea of Galilee, where Christ says, "Thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church," when it came time to memorialize that particular location, the rock was important, not the floor of the church. And so the rock comes right up through the bottom of the floor. And that's the way it was. It was an image in which the place was as important as the monument. And I think that's worth remembering in the style in which we build today. We seem to have lost a sense of place, and therefore can't build so that the place itself is significant. The early basilica made allowances for that place, and you would walk down, you would honor the burial place of a particular saint. In the case of this building, on your left, that's San Lorenzo, outside the walls. You never buried somebody inside the walls, always outside. And so most of the early churches were built outside walls of cities. And the basilica form which they used, they didn't say, we're early Christians, let's design something in an early Christian architecture. The basilica was established by the Greeks as an architectural form. The Romans carried it on, and the Christians adopted it. Christians also adopted a lot of other stuff, like they ripped off marble. They stole an awful lot of stuff. The early Christians were great at midnight requisitions. They tore down temples and they built their own churches out of the remains of pagan buildings. But no matter how large or how small, that basilica style was the thing that remained. A flat roof, a little clear story, longitudinal, a very long aisle. If you would visit the churches today, contemporary, no matter how modern, or as we say in our trade, modern, which is a dirty word, you'll find that we still tend to build a majority of our churches in this very long fashion, so that what you see the most of as you sit in church is hair, with the backs of other people's heads. And liturgy may have changed radically from this time, but our solutions to liturgical settings has changed very little. It may have gotten dressed up, may have been put into fancy new clothes, but the essential arrangement is the same. The outside of the early Christian church was nothing. In fact, you can go by a lot of these really marvelous and important works of art and architecture today, thinking they're railroad stations, and just keep right on going. But inside, they are full of mosaic. This says a lot about the nature of the church. It was introverted. It was addressing a rather secret society. You had to knock on the door and say something like, "St. Paul sent me," or something of that sort. But they didn't advertise. They didn't promote. There's no big sign in front of San Apollinare Nuovo that says, "We're having church services at 9:30 and at 10:45. Between there somewhere, and we'll have men's club meetings and such an evening." They didn't advertise at all. When the church moves east, at the time of Constantine, it changes its format slightly. And here you have a whole city built on two continents, the only one I can think of. Half of it is in Europe and half of it is in Asia. Constantinople, and half of this church, which is the supreme work of art of the Byzantine Empire, half of this style is Western and half of it is Eastern. It's a longitudinal basilica plan, but it has a dome over the top of it. And the dome is an Oriental motif, the longitudinal plan is a Western motif. To break that down even more abstractly, you can think of the Western idea as a line and the Eastern idea as a point. And the more you look at Eastern and Western art, the more you see the differences between lines and points. This is the Hagia Sophia, which, as far as monuments go, has got to be one of the great edifices ever put up by human hands. The dome hovers over this building like a saucer getting ready to land from some other world. The highest Gothic cathedral would swing inside of the Hagia Sophia like the clapper inside of a bell. About 230. The Beauvais Cathedral, which goes up, it was so high that it fell down twice, and then finally they said, forget it. Goes up about 187 feet, or about to where the dome begins. The pendantives, which are a device which Justinian used, was invented for this building. You've got this dome, round thing, sitting on a square. You got to figure out how to make a dome sit on top of a square without falling in. Well, there's one way of doing it, and that's to make the dome look bigger, or build it bigger than the square so that it rests right on top of the piers. That looks very dumb. Mainly because you've got a couple arcs sticking out over the outside of the square. So you want the dome to be the same exact width as the inside of the square. But if you do that, it's going to fall in. So you've got to go from the square to the round. It took centuries to figure that out, and they finally got it worked out in the Hagia Sophia with the pendantive. It's that little curved triangular thing you can see right on your left. It goes up, it comes forward, and goes around simultaneously. And so you've got four of those, one on each pier, and the top of those pendantives form the drum of the dome. That dome was so heavy that it fell in once, and they had to build it again. And the second time, they decided to build it hollow. That's actually two domes, one built inside of the other. And the whole Hagia Sophia is built in such a way that you could throw it into the water. I mean, if you could throw it into the water, it would float. The whole building would float. It's covered with mosaic, which were in turn covered over by the Ottoman Turks when they overthrew the Byzantine Empire. Their religion did not allow for images. So they plastered over all of those mosaics, and the plaster has fallen down, and they're beginning gradually to restore the images on the Hagia Sophia. But the mosaic is, a majority of it, is 22-karat gold leaf embedded in glass. And you can measure the mosaics in the Hagia Sophia by the square acre. There's a little monument a little closer to us, south of Venice in Ravenna, which is modeled after the Hagia Sophia, and it's called San Vitale, built at the same time by the same emperor, Justinian. Once again, they weren't interested in an outside character. You could walk past the San Vitale on the outside, and it would look like a kind of a warehouse. But on the inside, once again, you've got a mosaic cycle. Everything you see on that picture on the left is either mosaic or marble or alabaster. Every square inch. Mosaic is working an art form by using glass cubes, and the glass cubes are 1/2 by 1/2 by 1/2 inch. Now you can figure making an image that's measurable by the square acre by just sticking little glass cubes into concrete. The color range is also rather remarkable. There are 8,000 different color possibilities in mosaic. Interesting thing in that building. In fact, you can see it. Oops, excuse me. There we go. Right over, you've got Christ on the throne of judgment, and you can see just down the wall from that a little panel, which is this panel here on your right. That is the Emperor Justinian and his retinue. Now, a couple things you learn right away just by looking at the imagery. On the opposite wall is the Empress Theodora. The Empress Theodora, when she was a child, was a prostitute and a bear trainer, a tremendous combination, which later on as Empress stood her in good stead. But you'll notice that both the Empress and the Emperor have halos. The halos are done in red, which is the most expensive. The red was more expensive than gold because you had to make it out of mercury. So these two people were considered as living saints. But even more than that, if you check the shield of the Emperor, you'll find that he was the monogram of Christ, the chrismon. And you'll also, if you count the number in his party, you'll see that there are 12 people with him. The Emperor was more than a living saint. He was the personification of Christ himself. And he lived out his daily routine, doing things in the manner of Christ. He would go around feeding hungry, usually 12 at a time. He would wash people's feet. He would, and when you walked into his throne room, you walked on your hands and knees, and at the sound of a great trumpet, the throne, which was full of emeralds and pearls and rubies, would just simply take off like a bird. It just flew up into the sky. They did this by some incredible mechanical means, but every visitation to the throne room of the emperor was like going to the Transfiguration Mountain.
Why are these pictures all
standing on one foot? Oh. Well, actually, if you count, some feet are missing. In a couple pictures, you've got, in the Byzantine age, you've got too many feet. I know you've got a beautiful picture where you've got six guys and you've got 13 feet, which is really sort of funny. Remember I said Byzantium is a combination of East and West. And what you've got in the modeling of the faces and the figures is a Greek tradition. It's called a sculpturesque mode of representation. I'm starting to talk like an art professor, and I apologize. But what you've got in the feet, and in some other indications, which are flattening of figure and design elements, is a highly oriental motif. So you've got, once again, in the style of Byzantium, a juxtaposition of an oriental and a Western tradition. No, not necessarily. The way they depicted in the East, in the Oriental tradition, and you have this, for example, in the Egyptian, very much, the best way to depict a foot is not by showing it absolutely flat. If they were to depict a foot right, all you would see would be the front of the toes, which would look like four little bumps and a bigger bump, which is not the way a foot looks. And so, you know, like the Egyptians would show a profile like that, but the side of the chest doesn't look like a chest, so they put the chest forward and still keep the profile like that, you know. Now, the front of feet don't look so good, so they put the feet like that, the chest like that, the profile like that, you know. They just turn the body in order to make it the most recognizable. You have no troubles telling that those were feet. The Byzantine people considered that if they showed you the feet straight on, you might have difficulty deciding that those were actually feet. They just looked like ends of toes. I think they're right. The Byzantine people had an awful lot of trouble with this icon business, with the making of images. And there was a faction in, I guess the whole Byzantine Empire went through a sort of Missouri Synod thing, in which half the people said making images was a really good idea, the other half said it was heresy. Well, the half that said it was a really bad idea, kicked the half that really liked the images out of the country. In fact, they slew the priests. They did a whole horrible thing. The iconoclastic controversy in Byzantium was just full of blood. And so the people who fostered the icons, the image makers, went and hid out in various parts of the world, in very secluded, isolated areas. And, I mean, they really hid out. They built little monasteries, little monastic communities on the tops of outcroppings like these, where the only way you could get at them was by going up and down in a basket. Their food went up and down in the basket. The monks themselves went up and down in the basket. This was the beginning of the monastic movement, and it was, even though it started in the Byzantine age, was the real system that saved Europe. Ultimately, Europe depended upon the strength of the monastic community for its survival. These particular monasteries are in Greece. And these are the kinds of images that these people had to run for their lives in order to protect. Now the real problem is we can't explain, I can't explain to you how the Byzantine community really felt about these things. That picture on your left is a picture of the Virgin Mary. That picture on your right is a picture of Jesus Christ. That's to us, but not to them. To them, the picture on the left was the Virgin Mary. The picture on the right was Jesus Christ. They didn't venerate these icons in exactly the same way that they venerated Christ or the Virgin Mary, but they considered them the presence of Christ, the presence of the Virgin Mary, and thus to decorate them with pearls, with diamonds, with rubies, was not really to venerate an image, but was to venerate the Virgin Mary herself, or venerate Christ himself. So they considered it no form of idolatry. Dorothy, you probably are drooling at the variety of,
yes,
of stones and the settings.
How they were cut.
No. actually, the cutting for many of these stones is incredible. It was done by string.
String.
The people would dip string into a carborundum kind of material, and they would just rub string over these hard, hard rocks until they finally formed a crack enough that they could facet them.
What's the image on the chest of the Virgin Mary?
That's Jesus. And of course, once again, it looks kind of like a little 40-year-old man with, he's got 5 o'clock shadow and everything. And what's that? You know, that's not the baby. Well, that's right. They were not interested in depicting the babiness of Jesus. They were interested in depicting his totality, his wholeness, his manhood, all of it. And so the result is an abstraction. The reality of anyone is the reality of body and soul. And so they had to depict them abstractly. It's when you come to the Lord's table tonight, someone is going to hand you a piece of bread that they made in the oven last night and said, "Take, eat, this is my body." And someone is going to hand you is it Manischewitz we use around here, or Bardenheier's, or whatever it is. And someone is going to hand you a cup and tell you to drink and say, "Take, drink, this is my blood." And you know it to be the truth. You know that it is, and you know it by faith. Well, this extension of the sacramental for the Byzantine people extended also into the area of images.
Is the picture on our right in good focus?
Maybe not. I can't.
I know there's several of them on that region.
Yeah, the screen over here is at an angle, and that's the reason for it. Now, what happens even during the Byzantine age? Look at whoever wondered about the feet. Check the feet on the ones on the on your left. There was this tremendous migration of peoples that moved from the east to the west, and during all of this time, constant overlappings of people, of ideologies, of images, and the way they worked. The image on the left is what happened when Islam tried to make it right through the Byzantine Empire, and all of their navy was sunk, and so they had to go across land, and the only way Islam could get to Europe across land was to go across North Africa. So the Islamic invasion of Europe happened by crossing North Africa, going up through Spain, and finally they were stopped by Charles Martel at Poitiers. But in the meantime, all of that movement and migration and combinations of people resulted in some really neat images. Now, Islam was not allowed to make images of any kind. They got to Spain, and there was a whole community of very fervent Christians dating all the way back from St. James. And these people even converted some of the Islamic people. And when the Christians of Spain got together with the Islamic converts, they produced an art form which is called Mozarabic, and it's a combination of Spanish and looks like rugs, Islamic rug patterns, and it's just delightful. The colors are phosphorus and sometimes hard to look at. The faces are not individuals, it's a pattern, and it's just sheer celebration. Another great center during all of this time of the wandering peoples was Ireland. Of all places, Little Ireland was responsible for spreading a monastic community that started up in Ireland and spread all the way as far south as Vienna. And you've got them down in Switzerland too, all started by the Irish. And the great works of art at this time, because everybody was in a period of migration, was not just simply monuments. People, you know, who were going to move from one place to another didn't plan on 35-year building programs. Their monuments were the books, portable. And this is what we call the Dark Ages, because we can't find any great big monuments to shed any light on their life. But they were not dark. They were not dark at all. Incredible facility and technique. And the year 1000 came. And nothing was being built. And you can imagine why. The people were convinced during the year 1000 that the millennium was going to end all building programs. So 994, 995, nobody started building any churches. In fact, it was a rather chaotic time. The year 1000 came, and people sat around and waited for the last judgment. And the year 1001 came, and people were still not sure. 1002 came, and people thought, well, we'll give them one or two more years. Maybe God's calendar and our calendar are not the same calendar. But by the time the year 1004 came, it was such an exuberant time on the face of the earth that people went berserk. They went crazy for the building of churches. And the people responsible for the building of churches, most of them dedicated to Saint Michael, the angel of judgment, for favors granted. Most of them were built by the monastic communities, which were, up to that time, responsible for sheltering, for taking care of the people. Most of the little cities were built around the monastic center. And they were intended to be protective kinds of things from the wandering tribes, from vandals. These were churches that you could pour boiling oil from the walls down on invading Christmas carolers and whoever was, the Girl Scout salesman and things like that. Whoever was pesting you at the time. But they built funny. I mean, they built out of sheer joy. The building on your right shows what heritage was really left them from the Roman, and this is called the Romanesque Age. You try and build an arch, like a Roman arch, over a wall, but you got a funny kind of look. First of all, you can't build an arch very wide without having to pile all kinds of garbage up against the outside of the building just to keep the arch from pushing out. And they didn't want to pile all that stuff on the outside. They would think of anything they could do in order to create a reasonable interior. They were just experimenting, having fun. For example, the building on your left at Tournu, they decided, well, maybe we ought to, instead of running the tunnel longitudinally, we'll run it sideways, and we'll just have a series of these sideways running tunnels. And as a result, the walking from the narthex to the apse is a very bumpy procedure. You're just like going from one little sideways tunnel into the other. This building, by the way, at Tournu, is one of the most delightful buildings you've ever been in your life, once you understand the history and the delight of this particular time, the Romanesque Age. See how the tunnels run crossways as you go down the aisle, but look what happens when they run into the side aisle. They thought on the side aisle that they would run it long ways, and then they ran the tunnel laterally across this way. And so what happened, you had one tunnel going one way, one tunnel going the other way, and they met. Intersecting barrel vaults, we call that. And when you have an intersecting barrel vault, you have a groin vault. And they accidentally invented the Gothic Age. That's what you have in the Gothic Cathedral, is a groin vault. And it was pure accident. There are a lot of other things that are pure accident in that little church. Well, no, I don't think they're pure accident. Once again, just coming under the law and responding with sheer joy and delight at being free from the judgment caused them to do strange things. This is also at Tournu, and you can see that little groin vault above the side aisle there. The whole ceiling system looks very Gothic. And it is, but we're still in the middle of the Romanesque Age. They built a chapel, which is about 2 feet deep. There's nothing in it. And if you walked out of that chapel, you got two steps of 6-inch height. The next step is about a 20-foot drop. You would break an arm and a leg going to the chapel there. And it's planned that way. It's intentional. It's just for fun. There are a bunch of things that are just for fun in the Romanesque Age. Look at the side of the Cathedral of Pisa. They decided that they were sick and tired of using green and white marble, and they found some pink, and they just switched colors halfway down the line. There is no building committee living on the face of Christendom today that would do a thing like that. I mean, can you see the architect? The masons were the architects of these things. They just thought, George, it's time for a little pink. And so they switched. Look at where they changed from the green and white to the pink and white on the side there, and you'll see that the height of the arches on that facade also changes. You see them? The heights of those arches of that blind arcade are just bouncing up and down for no reason whatsoever. Also notice the windows. One arch has a window in it, the next arch does not. There's a perfectly logical pattern to it, except for one. You see? There's a pattern there and it's broken. And there's no reason why it should be broken, except they're just tired of window, no window, window, no window, window, no, what a drag, you know. Let's try two with no window, George. Now you can see the transept where the wall goes back and then comes out again. That's the transept area, and you see a little window there that's actually larger It also doesn't fit the pattern. Not only does that window not fit the pattern of the other windows, but it doesn't go on into anything. There is no room there. That's just a window that has no reason. No reason whatsoever. If you go inside this particular building, you would find over the altar, over the high altar, a railing leading up to a door. There's a staircase. It's way, way up there. And you can't get onto the railing without taking a 17-foot jump. You can't get onto that little staircase. But once you get on and go up there, you find that the door at the top of the staircase is painted onto the marble. Now, can you reconcile those two things happening simultaneously? That all the time they come under this, under judgment. Nobody walking into one of these cathedrals can escape the judgment. Christ on the throne of judgment is over every single doorway, the entrance to every single Romanesque cathedral. And yet there's the sheer delight and joy. It's humor. One of the best examples I can think of it is this gal. This is Eve. Done by a sculptor, the sculptor of Autun, by a fellow by the name of Giselbertus. She is in the process of being tempted. She is reaching for the apple. And she already knows she has sinned. Even in the process of reaching for that apple. So here is a man who understands how to carve out of stone human emotion, human feeling, pathos, the whole business. He understands the nature of sin, but he also understands the nature of grace. On your right, three wise men in one bed. Now, I don't know how things were in the Romanesque times. Maybe these were on the top of columns, and maybe there wasn't room for three beds. But you got all three guys with only 2 feet. Three guys with only 2 feet. Now this is the same guy that did that beautiful Eve, right? That understands the nature of sin. The angel has touched. One guy's got his arm outside the blanket, and that's good, because that gives the angel something to touch. And notice that the touch of the angel has opened the one wise man's eye. Now just read what's going on in that wise man's mind. Is that you, Balthazar? Who that? Who is that touching my hand? Three guys in one bed. One guy with his eyes open. That is funny. Now what's even funnier than that is that these things are 75 feet up in the air and you can't see them. You can't see these things. All this delight is floating up in the ceilings of the cathedrals. This humor is singing around through these columns. Look at Mary. Look what Giselbertus did. For Mary and Joseph and the flight to Egypt gave the donkey meal. That's, talk about making the rough places plain. And look at the donkey. The happiest one of the whole bunch is the donkey. He's got a meaning. So here are people who are aware that the judgment has passed them by, but they are constantly reminded of the judgment by putting Christ on the throne of judgment over their doorways. Yet when they walk in, there's this delight at experimenting, there's this delight at responding to the joy of life and living. And it seems to me that this combination of being free from the judgment and responding with joy is what faith is all about. That's faith. We used to call the Gothic Age the Age of Faith. I think we ought to move it up one period and call it the Romanesque Age, the Age of Faith. Because by the time the Gothic Age came, the Romanesque people had pretty well solved the problems, and the Gothic people, really all they had to do was respond with sheer ingenuity. Of course they did, and it was glorious. And you can just watch, in the Romanesque churches, you had that rather dour Ein Festeburg facade. When you get to the Gothic Age, they're showing all they've got right on the outside. And the cathedrals are beginning to go after the community. They're beginning to envelop. And they are of cities. They are not from religious communities. They are from secular communities. The cities are building the cathedrals now, not the monasteries. And the cities and the cathedrals are one thing. And the doors of the cathedrals reach out and apprehend the community. And the whole faith business is mounted right on the front. They bring some of their old images with them. And Christ and the Gothic has now come down from the throne of judgment and is down on the trumo, and people can walk by into the church and pat le bon Dieu on his big toe. He is not only up on the throne of judgment, he is right next to them. And the buildings they build dissolve with light. Can you imagine all of the cathedrals painted like this? They were, on the outside. Can you imagine going past Reims Cathedral or Amiens with all of its statues and seeing them painted like this? What a feast. What a delight for the eye. But it was really a great I am. It's a me, O Lord, kind of celebration. And so I distinguish the Romanesque age from the Gothic age by calling the Gothic Age not the age of faith, but the age of piety. And of course, piety winds up like that under the throne of judgment. And what you've got at the end of the Gothic Age was an incredible image of death, which allowed the Renaissance to depict with Michelangelo the Last Judgment. And who is sitting on the throne of judgment? The same figure that we had in the early Christian depiction, with the throne of heaven being held up by the God of the sky, Zeus, and Jesus Christ is Apollo. Apollo. That ultimately is what happens to piety. The history of the church from that time on is one really of trying to reform and counter-reform. The reformers picked up an iconoclastic binge, and the anti-reformation people brought the images back into the church. So that during the Baroque age, things got rather propagandistic, and you built the insides of your churches as though to tell everybody, heaven ain't nowhere else but inside this church. It was almost the opposite of the Gothic age. What we've got now are really responses to one or more of those particular idioms, so that we can build now in a Romanesque style, which looks like it's trying to keep people out. Well, I just showed this Rembrandt from the Protestant tradition just to let you know that he never got a commission from a church. Nobody ever commissioned Rembrandt to do a painting for a church. Incredible. Well, we can look at styles of architecture, of church architecture now, and say, my goodness, that doesn't look like a church. Well, the catacombs didn't look like churches either until they became churches. What the church looks like is people doing God's business. And we can build it out of stainless steel, but it's still Gothic. Matthew, would you turn on the middle projector for me, hon? I thought I would just run a couple of contemporary examples of church art and architecture. Many of them are mine, some of them aren't, and I'm not going to tell you which is which. But like Leo said last night so beautifully, nobody wants to tell you about heaven unless he's been to hell. And you don't want to put church art and architecture into a context other than that of people. And so the contemporary examples of architecture I'd just like to show in a kind of environment which includes where we are. I'm terribly German. I don't apologize for it, but every now and then I have to deliberately get Scandinavian just in order to maintain my self-respect around this place. So I've got Grundtvig's church on the right. I'd like to just let you see some of the examples and see if you can't put them into a context of some of the historical styles that we've already seen.
Have a good day.